and build a next-generation peer-to-peer system. And Cisco has also given some funding for a postdoc, Andrei Sargentov. And one of the things that CMI is interested in is getting the world's telecom industries out of their slump. And many of the issues facing the world phone companies are not entirely engineering problems and not entirely economics problems, but they have got a bit of engineering and a bit of economics in them. And peer-to-peer systems are very much like that. Now, we all know the traditional distributed computing paradigm, client-server. You've got a whole bunch of clients which provide user interface and some rudimentary processing perhaps, but with the data being kept on a big server somewhere. And this is a great architecture where it works. Web services, we all know and love. And it's going to continue being successful where it works. But there are more and more cases where it doesn't particularly work very well or very economically. It's expensive to have big server farms. It's expensive to make them robust. And it can be expensive to deal with all the bandwidth demands. We'll see a number of examples of that. So peer-to-peer systems, again, we've had a number of people talking about them over the last few days. The basic concept is that you've got a distributed systems architecture with no centralized control, where the nodes are symmetric in function. You can have a large number of nodes which may be unreliable, right? These may be just random people in the net who join, participate in your system for a few weeks or days or hours. And you try and design the software so that you can get a more reliable, more dependable whole out of these less dependable parts. And what's enabling peer-to-peer systems is, of course, technology improvement. Now, it's important to realize that peer-to-peer systems aren't something that just happened a few years ago. Because when you think about traditional human relationships, whether we communicate by speech or by post, or later by telephone or by email, we are forming a social network which is, in effect, a peer-to-peer network. Now, we have our friends, and our friends overlap with other people, and this totality creates a network which is human society. Another early model that we've got is Usenet, and again, people tend to forget the lessons of Usenet when building peer-to-peer systems. This goes back quite a number of years now. What Usenet added to the way human society works is that firstly you've got a data structure, the news group, right, which is a list of articles which may have some relationships between them. And then there's a communications architecture, flood-fill, which I'll come and discuss in more detail later. Now, my introduction to the world of peer-to-peer was a paper that I wrote for PragerCrypt in 96, the Eternity Service, and this was a proposal for a system engineered to be highly resistant to censorship. And it was prompted by a couple of things. One was when a bank in the UK got a court order against me to hand over documents relevant to its system security, because I was at the time involved in doing research on the causes of fraud against cash machines. And the second thing, the spur that got it going, was the case of the Church of Scientology against the Fishman affidavit. For those of you who haven't heard of the Fishman case, Fishman was a minister with the Church of Scientology. He rose up through the ranks in the organization. Then he had a court case with them, and he leaked in his court case in an affidavit certain Church of Scientology documents, which tended to suggest that the Scientologists were engaged in devil worship. The Scientologists had the interesting idea of using copyright law to shut him up. They said that the documents were their copyright, and so they sued him in California and here and there and everywhere. And as part of this battle, they got an order against an anonymous remailer, pnet.fi, in Helsinki, whereby the operator of this anonymous remailer had to disclose the relationship between ingoing and outgoing traffic. And this was bad news from the net's point of view, because it meant that for the first time you had a legal threat being used to close down a service. Now, what this made me think of, as I had been invited to speak in Prague, and as Gutenberg, the inventor of printing, had some relationships with Bohemia, was the whole business of the effect that printing had on our lives. Now, there's a famous cryptologist, Gus Simmons, once ran a survey in which he asked dozens and dozens of people what were the 10 most important inventions ever. He asked mathematicians, engineers, artists, lawyers, and the one invention that appeared on all of their lists was printing. Right? This clearly stood out as a consensus view as being the most important thing that was ever invented. And in the West, of course, we ascribe this to Johannes von Gatten zur Gutenberg, although the Koreans had it 100 years before and the Chinese a bit before then. How this looked from the point of view of English history can be seen from the history of the translation of the Bible. The first person who translated the Bible into English, Wycliffe, in 1382, was fired from his job. He was an academic at Oxford, and sent to go and live in a remote monastery. And the church simply gathered up the extant copies of this heretical book and put it in a library where people couldn't get at it. But 100-odd years later, once printing had come along, we had the second person to translate the Bible into English, William Tyndale, who was the founder of Cambridge University Press. And he first published the New Testament in 1525. The government didn't like this, and they started persecuting him, so he fled to Holland, and he kept on printing New Testaments and started work on the Old Testament. Eventually, they caught him, and they burned him at the stake in 1536. But by then, he had printed and sold 55,000 copies of the New Testament. And in the English-speaking world, that was the trigger that led to the Reformation. The key technological innovation was that all of a sudden, it was not possible for the princes and the bishops to control the spread of knowledge. Once a book had been published, you couldn't unpublish it. And the worry that we had to face following the Scientologists' court decision in Finland was that will electronic publishing reverse this important historical development? Will it make it possible for the princes and bishops to come down on one particular book and say, this is a wicked book, it is hereby unpublished? Then we were worried about e-books sitting on a small number of servers. Now, of course, we're worried about trusted computing. And no doubt there will be other worries come through in the future. So the idea that we had for the Eternity Service was quite simple. A distributed cooperative anonymous storage system where you would donate some storage space to a common pool and you would get in return some tokens that would let you use a fraction of that. And then what happens is that your files are encrypted and replicated across a number of servers, and you have anonymous remailers which will enable you to identify the files and get them back. Now, you don't know what files are stored on your own system, so you have plausible deniability. And this also means that the lawyers don't know which system they have to go to find this illegal Fishman affidavit. So this was the idea that we had, and Adam Back produced a prototype. He hacked this together in a few days, and after a few days more, there was the first attack on it. It was a trolling attack. Somebody put up a page of information about that was extolling the virtues of sex between men and boys. But nonetheless, various other people tried to develop better working systems, and we had systems like Publius and Freenet and Freehaven coming after that. Then, of course, we had this phenomenon of Napster coming along in 1999. And after the music industry lawyers started coming down on Napster, we then had this merging of the two ideas, the idea of a censorship-resistant system and the idea of a music-sharing system, and we've seen GNUtella and Kazaa and all sorts of other services coming online. And, of course, this is a flashpoint, as we've been hearing. Some people consider this to be the ultimate form of democracy on the internet, and other people say that it's the ultimate threat to copyright protection on the internet. Now, before we join that debate, let's note that there's many interesting legal uses as well. One of the things that we have been playing around with recently is helping people at our university library. And they have got a very, very large collection of old manuscripts. This is from 12th century synagogue in Cairo. It is one of the earliest recorded instances of musical notation from that part of the world. They've also got old manuscripts which have got the earliest forms of double entry bookkeeping, the earliest this, the earliest that. And so these are of interest to a very, very, very wide range of scholars, musical scholars, historians of accountancy, and you name it. But at present, if you want to consult this collection of old manuscripts, you pretty well had to go to Cambridge and get yourself enrolled in the project and sit down and work. And so my colleagues in the library have raised some money to digitize these old manuscripts and make them available to scholars. Now, the expensive bit is, of course, the labor involved in getting the manuscript, setting it up on the camera, taking a high-resolution photograph, making sure that you've got the cataloging data right, and so on and so forth. But one problem these guys came up against is the sheer volume of data that you start to generate once you start producing large numbers of very high-resolution images. Right, these images are many tens of megabytes each. And when you add it all up, the problem becomes, how do you go about implementing a reliable, low-cost terabyte web server? So that's one example that got us interested again in the peer-to-peer business. Another example is music. I'm interested in folk music, and there's a guy in America who, for a number of years, used to go to a number of pipe band competitions, and he would record the performances and put them on his website. But he then had to stop making these available simply because he couldn't cope with the download charges. Again, if we can come up with a better way of hosting perfectly legal, innocuous material online, then there's a lot of very positive uses for it. An even bigger potential application is being talked about now in the UK. The British Broadcasting Corporation, our state television company, decided just before some recent management changes that they would make their old archive available to everybody who wanted to work with it on something very similar to a BSD license, so that you could take old musical performances and plays and so on from the BBC, and you could transform them in various ways and do what you wanted to them. That's now being looked at again because the BBC has changed management, but a lot of people are hoping and lobbying for it to go ahead. Again, one of the big problems is cost. If you have just got a few gigabytes of material, then it can be put on the BBC's existing website. But once you get into the terabytes and once you get into the petabytes, that's simply not the case anymore. It starts to cost serious money if you have to do it all in one centralized server farm. So as from about next month, you should be seeing the first of the Creative Archive material appearing on the BBC website. But within about 18 months, there's going to be a requirement for some kind of better solution. And so there's a possibility, and maybe we can do something there. The next application that I'm interested in, and that I'll talk about a bit in more detail later, is fixing Usenet. Usenet used to be great. If you think back about 10 or 15 years, when only geeks used the internet, and the press hadn't heard of us yet, you know, you had all these news groups with all sorts of interesting stuff happening where you could meet all sorts of people that it was great to know. But at the moment, Usenet is beginning to collapse. It's not scaling particularly well. The weight of spam, the weight of binaries, and for a typical small to medium-sized ISP, the sheer cost of running a news feed are beginning to cripple that service. Is there some way we can fix it? Next example of a potentially suitable public infrastructure application is a news syndication and distribution service. Organizations such as Indie Media have showed that there is another way of distributing news other than funneling it all through Reuters and Bloomberg and the Press Association. But what sort of infrastructure is ideal for that? What sort of infrastructure should there be to allow, let's say, a small newspaper in Chile to syndicate its stories to whoever might want it in China or India or Canada? And then finally, there's the old question that many people think about in peer-to-peer terms, distributed personal backup. If I contribute a few gigabytes of my own hard disk space, can I turn that into high-quality replicated backup service so that I can have my stuff kept by other people in a cooperative way? Is there any way that you can put that together in a way that the quality can be reasonably assured? Another thing to think about is that in peer-to-peer systems, if you work for a company, there's a lot of business opportunities. Up till now, if you look at security research papers in the academic literature, you'll find that about 90% of them are on confidentiality, including a huge literature on encryption, maybe 9% on integrity, but only about 1% on availability. And it's only in the last 10 years that we've had any papers at all on availability, and only since we got distributed denial of service attacks that we get a significant number of them. But if you look at how businesses spend their money, even 10 years or 20 years ago, a typical IT shop had it spending the other way around, right? I did some work for banks in the 80s, and typically most of the security and disaster recovery budget went on maintaining a backup computer center, plus multiple redundant communications links. That accounted for tens of millions a year. Then a few million a year would be spent on paying the salary of a few dozen internal auditors who would go and do code walkthroughs and inspect the change control procedures so that we had confidence in the integrity of the bank's data processing. But as for confidentiality, hey, there were a few encryption boxes and that was it. So you've had this very strange reversal in that academic researchers have concentrated on things in a quite different order from what businesses have been interested in. And there's an opportunity, I think, to start doing some serious constructive work on availability. And what does availability mean? Well, it means that you have to be able to deal with failures of nodes and communications. You need, especially nowadays, to be able to cope with flash crowds. That wasn't the case in banking 15 years ago. You could predict with great accuracy what your maximum volume of credit card transactions would be, because it was 120% of what you had at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on the last Saturday before Christmas. Easy. But now, since people invented Slashdot, it's not so deterministic anymore. How can you go about building systems that can expand opportunistically to cope with being Slashdotted? And if you can do that, then maybe you can also do something about distributed denial of service. Okay, so we're interested in doing peer-to-peer, and we're interested in trying to do it a little bit better. Well, the first roadblock I think people are beginning to realize is that it's about getting the incentives right. The first generation of peer-to-peer systems, such as the Eternity service, for example, went on the assumption that everything went into one big pot. And so you could use such a system to store your school band recordings or material defamatory of the Scientologists, but other people might be storing porn in it or stuff that was critical of the government, which might get you into trouble if you were in, say, China. And so this acted as a brake on the take-up. And you might think that, well, okay, we might fight to protect academic material from censorship, but we might not be able to be We might not be prepared to make the same kind of effort to protect music from a band that we don't like. And who's taking these decisions anyway? How can we figure out how decisions are taken about what sort of system, what sort of content gets allowed in a particular peer-to-peer system and which doesn't? And then we began to look at later systems, and later systems such as Kazaa don't insist on putting everything in one pot. In a system like that, you basically decide what you want to store on your own system and then share it. So does this give us a way forward? Well, at a couple of papers that were published 3 weeks ago at the workshop on economics and InfoSec, we did some proper analysis of this. On a paper I did with Andrei Sargentov, we looked at the possible application of electoral theory, also called social choice theory, to shared control of peer-to-peer systems. And one of the things that we realized is that we can apply to computer science a large body of knowledge that has been developed over the last 50 years by economists and political scientists, which examines what sort of electoral systems work in which ways and how difficult it is to manipulate them. And there's a famous theory by Ken Arrow going back over 50 years now, which says that there's no such thing as an ideal electoral system. If you write down a series of quite reasonable things that you might require an electoral system to do, you can then prove that no system exists which will do them all. And so electoral science, if you like, is about exploring trade-offs. And in particular, what we realized is that there's results which show that deterministic systems for doing shared control of systems are going to be either dictatorial or manipulable. In other words, you will be particularly vulnerable to being manipulated by some small but cohesive minority of dissidents within your system. What can you do about this? Well, there are some things that you can do with randomized systems, and in particular, we come up with a number of ways in which we can design existing reputation systems better. It turned out that a number of the people who'd built reputation systems had just not been aware of this electoral theory literature. But nonetheless, this seems a relatively difficult road to go down. And if you just think about human society, think about how difficult it is and how long it takes for a state to acquire a system of politics and elections with which everybody's comfortable and which works even halfways efficiently and fairly. So there's a second thread that we started to look at. Another paper that you can get from the Weiss website, or from our website, on the economics of censorship resistance. And this basically convinced me that what we had done with the Eternity Service 8 years ago were wrong. Because in the random model, as we call it, systems like Eternity and Freenet and the original distributed hash tables basically put files at random locations within the system. So if you're part of a system, you get some random subset of all the files in the system, and you've got no choice over what you're storing and sharing. The other model, which we call the discretionary model, which systems like Kazaa and GNUtella and eDonkey use, allow you that sort of discretion. And they have done better in the marketplace. Now, why should this be? Well, we come up with a simple model in which we assume that each user has got a preference for what we call red resources and blue resources. It's enough to consider two types of resource. Whether this is music and porn or whatever, it doesn't matter because it's a general model that you can apply. And in the random model, you serve your share of what's in the system, and in the discretionary model, you serve the share that you prefer. So if the ith user prefers, let's say, Ri times T, the total resources of red, and Bi times T of blue, then that's your preference which you express. And the censor is somebody who may have a different preference. He's trying to push you towards a different split. And in a random case, you get an average of all the preferences in the system. And how we then build the model is we say that each user can then choose a certain amount of money to spend on defense. Whether this is technical defense, such as cryptography, or procedural defense, such as lawyers, we don't very much care. But we then assume that the more money you spend on defense, the closer you get to your preference rather than the censor's preference. And what we find is that in the discretionary model, firstly, defense budgets are higher. People will spend in equilibrium a larger amount of money defending against attack. And also, utility is higher. People are happier. And you know, this gives us a quantitative model of what's going on, which accords with what we actually observe out there. And this enables us to make a number of other deductions as well, which you can see in the paper. For example, using standard quadratic utility models, you can show that a defense based on solidarity will tend to fragment once people's utility is reduced by about half. And that's certainly the case, you know, once Napster started being sued. Anyway, you can, of course, take your own view on how useful these economic models are, and there's great controversy between theoretical economists and econometricians. But what this, together with the historical experience, tends to convince me is that if censorship resistance is your primary goal, then a federation of clubs maybe a better way to do it than a single system. So how this might work in the case of music is that instead of having one system like eDonkey or Kazaa, you would have a federation of fan clubs. Think of it as a kind of Usenet where each news group, if you like, contained postings of material from and material about different bands. And then it would be possible for each particular fan club to reach its own accommodation with the band. And you've got some musicians like David Bowie who want their fans to take their stuff and do all sorts of derivative work with it, and you've got other musicians who don't. And then each can negotiate their own outcome rather than having to have one outcome enforced on the whole world by RIA. So the sort of soundbite that we have for that is that you share what you control and control what you share. And other advantages that we think you can get from a discretionary model is that you get less incentive for people to cheat or to leave even when there is no censor. Because if you were caught in a system with a red majority and you actually prefer a blue majority of content, then the chances you'll say to hell with it and you'll leave. And the hope is that by going to a federated system, you can eliminate the need for complex elections, reputation systems, and so on, or at least you can reduce that need. So that's the first piece of thinking that we've been doing about peer-to-peer. And the second bundle of issues that we have to look at are how do you get really predictable dependability, and how do you get good coverage? Because if you've ever played with GNUtella, you know it's great for getting hold of popular stuff, but obscure files get lost. So if you're interested, say, in 1930s Cajun music or 1970s Northumbrian piping, then systems like that aren't very good for you. And it's certainly not very good if what you're trying to do is preserve ancient manuscripts, because the system will tend to replicate those resources that are in demand, and the resources that are demanded infrequently will just drop out of it. Now, as a benchmark, librarians that we talk to who provide archive libraries reckon that in an archive library, if more than 20% of your books are ever read by anybody, then you were too selective in your acquisitions policy. Right? So you cannot use something like GNUtella to run an archive of ancient manuscripts. It won't work. So what we've got to do is, on the one hand, get the economics right, and on the other hand, put in some really solid, good old-fashioned engineering. And this is where we come back to the distributed hash table. The challenge for the engineer is making stuff reliable and distributed, because you're going to have to have many servers to handle the load. At any point, some will have failed, and you don't know all that much about, and you can't easily control the geographical spread. So how do you get performance? Well, if you're someone like Akamai, you employ lots of PhDs from MIT. And what we're doing is we're getting some work done at MIT by Franz Kasuk and Robert Morris and some of the research students, and we're building this into this new system. The idea with a distributed hash table is that it provides a simple programming interface to distributed systems. How it works is that the programmer puts some data with a key into this API. The API has got a distributed hash table which is kept among a number of servers, replicated across about 300 servers, we reckon, in an implementation of Usenet. And the hash table in its software decides which nodes it's going to store it on. And then, when you want to get it back, you just do the reverse. In other words, what we're talking about is building some middleware which abstracts from the programmer the hard work of keeping track of what objects are kept in which nodes. So the idea is that the thing should look like one big hard disk to the programmer, but it should be internally organized as a peer-to-peer system so that you can get the performance, the load balancing, and the fault tolerance. So the idea, as I said, is a clean interface. We want things to be persistent and global. We want the DHT itself to be agnostic about what it's storing. And at this level in the engineering, you have to do that, because it's at the application level that you start building the complex data structures. The other interesting thing about distributed hash tables is that you can make them into a good shared infrastructure. At present, the internet has been good as a platform because many applications can share it. And some of us would say, unfortunately, Windows has had the same property. Many applications started to share it when it became obvious that the IBM PC, as it was called then, was going to beat the Mac. And there are serious issues of network externality here. If back in the days when the PC was fighting with the Mac for dominance, people programmed for both until it became clear that one of them, namely the IBM PC, was likely to win. And then what happened is that every software company developed their software for the PC first and for the Mac only second, if at all. And very often, these network externalities have worked in favor of the forces of darkness. But when we come to the DRM debate, I can perceive the possibility that they might work the other way around. Because the more universal and the more useful your platform is, the more likely it is that large numbers of people will write to it. And so when designing things like DHTs, we have to bear in mind that we're appealing not just to the users, but we're appealing to the application developers. And it's not just the applications I'm going to go on and talk about, such as Usenet, that we're interested in hosting, but also applications such as Wiki and the other things that we've been hearing about. What we're also interested in doing is to pool resources from many participants, because you get one externality from a successful large system if you can get lots of people to write programs for it. But if you're doing a massively shared storage system, then you get a second network externality, which is if you've got large numbers of participants, you firstly get a lot of hard disk, and secondly, you've got an awful lot of diversity, both geographically and over the kind of network access that there is. And this means that you can have a system that appeals more to more people, and also with time becomes more fault tolerant. Now, there's a number of technical challenges that we have to fix, and the guys at MIT, our colleagues there, have been working on this for 2 or 3 years. Lookup, failure handling, coping with systems in flux is perhaps the hardest of these issues. The more churn there is in a DHT, the harder it is to keep it stable. You need some kind of network awareness. So how one fixes this in practice is, of course, that you have a number of super peers, which we anticipate might in future be held at ISPs, which provide the hard core of the system. You have to worry about data integrity, load balancing for flash crowd. You have to worry about robustness with untrusted participants, and in particular, what happens if somebody's trying to close down your system and they subscribe 1 million machines, keep them up for a few weeks, and then unsubscribe them again. And there are also issues with heterogeneity, anonymity, and indexing. Okay. One can't always cope with all of these problems at the same time in all systems, but we think we're beginning to understand where the sensible trade-offs are. So what sort of applications can we use peer-to-peer systems for? Well, what we are currently building a prototype for is to try and fix Usenet news. Now, those of you who have used this for the 20 or so years it's been around, know how much it's deteriorated since, you know, the great days of 10 to 20 years ago. And the exponential growth in volume is largely to blame for this. The volume at the beginning of this year was well over a terabyte a day. And that means that if you're going to host Usenet news, it's very, very expensive. You need an awful lot of storage, you need an awful lot of bandwidth, and there's only a few dozen sites now offer a full feed. So it's about time that Usenet got re-engineered. How could we do that? Well, as I mentioned before, Usenet introduced a data structure, namely the news group, and a communications architecture, namely FloodFill. So this is basically how it works at present. You post an article to your local server, and the server then exchanges the message headers and the text with its peers. Right, so S1 knows S2 and S3, and it sends the articles along. And S3 then passes it on to S4, and so on. And the headers that I use are sorted into news groups. Now, you observe that this involves shipping all the message body everywhere between all the servers that are running a full feed, which accounts for most of the bandwidth. Also, if most of this is spam or in news groups that only few people read, then much of that bandwidth is wasted. So what can we do? Well, a suggestion that's often made is that you remove all binaries, because almost all of the volume at the moment is binaries. But then again, binaries are in high demand. And if you ran a non-binary service, as our university does, then you're not going to get as much custom as you could, and the system isn't going to fulfill its potential. Some people have in the past proposed having a header-only feed, in that the original posting site would just forward the headers, and if you wanted to get the article, you would then use some web protocol or whatever to fetch the article from the original posting site. But this caused all sorts of load and availability problems. The third proposal that people made was to consolidate servers, and this is what's actually been happening. There's a few big providers do a full news service, and this means that there's not a lot of diversity. There's a risk of attack, whether it's a physical attack or more likely a legal attack, think of the Scientologist lawyers, or some kind of failure. So the approach that we're proposing, Usenet DHT, works as follows. What we're going to do is store the article in a shared distributed hash table. And what this is going to mean is that, in effect, modulo the duplication that we do to provide availability, there will only be one single copy of Usenet. In practice, there will be perhaps four or five machines will have a copy of each article, and you can use more machines with news groups that would be particularly subject to attacks or censorship. And we design the DHT, which we believe we can do, so that we can handle increased volume. And how this is going to look in practice is that we hope we can get at least 300 ISPs who will each maintain a reasonably modern server-grade machine to handle their share of the DHT and keep it on a high-availability communications link. That means that we can get a reasonably stable population of machines to act as, if you like, the super peers within the core DHT ring. And these will, in effect, be providing a distributed high-performance cache for Usenet news to the ISPs themselves. The benefit from the ISPs are, of course, that they cut their bandwidth requirements and they provide high-quality news service to their customers. And bearing in mind what we've been saying about the need for a discretionary model to keep the incentives and the legal side of things right, Usenet already has this structure of news groups, so each side can decide which groups it's going to subscribe. Right? So if you're running an ISP in Saudi Arabia, you don't take alt.talk.malt whiskey. So here's how the thing will work. The user posts an article to a local server. The server then writes the article to a distributed hash table, so it's kept somewhere on the DHT ring. And then the server exchanges the headers as in the existing system. So at a stroke, we get rid of 99% of the bandwidth requirement at the cost of maintaining a high availability distributed index. And of course, all the servers will know about each article. Here's the kind of potential savings that one can be looking at. If you take a Usenet feed for the and you take all the groups, including binaries, then you needed something like 12 megabytes per second in bandwidth and 10 terabytes a week of storage. We reckon that we can cut the bandwidth requirement by two orders of magnitude to 120 kilobytes per second, which any ISP worth its salt should be able to cope with, at least in the developed world. And the storage is reduced not quite by as much because you need to do some replication, but something like 60 gigabytes a week, which again is doable for any reasonable sized ISP. The assumptions for that are a 300-site network with each site reading 1% of all the articles. There's other things that you can do on top of this, of course. One of the things that we've been thinking about is various novel moderation structures, because once the articles are stored in your DHT hash table, it then becomes straightforward for somebody to provide cleaned up feeds by simply running, you know, either an automated process such as a spam filter through a particular feed and then posting a signed list of the pointers to the articles that are thought to be good articles. And of course, you can provide a similar service using human intervention if you wish. So we can easily support facilities such as moderation. Okay, that's just an idea of how one particular application could be re-engineered on a next-generation peer-to-peer system. And as I've been sitting here listening to the talks today, I've been thinking about, well, you know, if Wikipedia is going to start running out of steam in server terms in 18 months' time, then, well, hey, we should have this built by then and, you know, we should be talking. In general, I think the point is that peer-to-peer systems have got a lot of promise, and we shouldn't let ourselves be too distracted by, you know, all the media fireworks about music sharing. Sure, that's going to continue to be an issue, but there are many, many other interesting things that we can do. DHTs, which we're working with, appear to provide us with a good way to build real peer-to-peer applications, because we can abstract most of the difficult stuff of keeping track of all the distributed systems issues away, and we can provide the applications programmer with something that's tractable and something that runs across a number of different applications. We believe that we can make it robust in the face of failures, and we can make it scalable not just in the sense that it doesn't become too impossibly difficult too quickly as you increase the number of servers, but you can actually increase the value to customers as you increase the number of servers because you get better performance, you get more reliability, and so on and so forth. And, well, you've seen a number of the applications we've been thinking about, content distribution, data archiving. And I think that the slogan that I put down here on the slide is that the trick is to get both the engineering and the economics right. Now, I've come at this from a very geeky background. You know, my background was a maths degree and then hardware engineering and stuff like that. And I've started learning economics fairly late in life. And I've been interested to see that we've been coming to many of the same conclusions that a number of the earlier speakers have been coming to when looking at things from the social point of view. And you know, I think this begins to mark at least the end of the beginning of the story of peer-to-peer systems, that we're now beginning to have a coherent picture of what these things look like as complete socio-technical systems, where we take into account both the people and the systems and the software. So that's what I had, and I'll take one or two questions if there are any.
Hello. My question is related to your system. Maybe I misunderstood the way that you think data should be distributed, because what DHT appears to me is simply a client-server application where you have the server who stores the data and the clients call it whenever they need it. That's the first part of my question. Second question is, redundancy also accounts for, well, resilience of data against destruction. If you have everything stored in one place, then of course that place is vulnerable, which is why there are so many DNS servers and name server and redundant, for instance, transcontinental communication cables and links. So I'd like you to answer to these two questions in a way that maybe I could understand where my flaw in the misunderstanding of your concept is.
Well, what's basically happening is that you have got a ring of 300 servers worldwide which cooperate to provide one large virtual server. So yes, it does look a bit like client-server programming in that the peer-to-peer functionality is encapsulated within the distributed hash table mechanism. What that means is that you get the redundancy that you're seeking, but there's a bit more subtlety on top of that, because you might not be using the same DHT ring, exactly the same set of machines for each particular purpose. If your ISP in Saudi Arabia is limited in what Usenet news groups he can prudently run, then he may be subscribed to smaller parts of the service than, let's say, a server in Boston or in Berlin. So yes, what this does is it makes peer-to-peer structures available within the more familiar framework of client-server computing, but still giving you the benefits of the resilience and redundancy.
And these 300 servers would actually lower the bandwidth and lower the load of what nowadays 50 servers do, as you have described, who mirror all of the Usenet currently?
Well, according to our calculations, yes. But of course, in the systems world, theory doesn't always get it right, and so we're actually busy building a prototype. And we should have some announcement on that, perhaps alpha code, perhaps towards the end of this year. But by next year, we hope to be able to get this up and running in beta at a number of real ISPs.
Thank you.
I'd like to know a little more about how a distributed hash works, particularly when the set of results can change.
Well, there's a number of papers on this. There's a whole series of papers by Robert Morris and Franz Kasshook at MIT. They're the real experts on this because they invented it. And you are right, distributed hash tables become inefficient if there's a lot of thrashing. If you forever have people joining and leaving the ring, then the communications bandwidth demand suddenly starts going up. And this is why if you're going to use this as a basic structure for a service like Usenet, you want to have a relatively stable population of machines within your distributed hash table so that you minimize the churn.
Thank you.
Mailing lists more or less filled the gap that Usenet created, but there are some advantages of Usenet over mailing lists. But it's very easy to set up your own mailing list, but very difficult to create a new Usenet news group because it's very complicated, the whole process. It's a little bit intransparent for groups who just want to create a mailing list. So what's the advantage of Usenet today over mailing lists?
I suppose ease of finding. I don't know. I'd have to go in and think about that. But bandwidth, yeah. Ease of finding the groups. The fact that they've been around. The fact that there are cultures associated with them. There's a number of different things. There's some work by other colleagues on thinking of better mechanisms for distributed elections, for setting up new news groups. Of course, there's some sense in which you could turn Usenet into a series of mailing lists. Hey, how would you handle really high volumes?
Okay.
Just a question relating to the one before. Did I understand correctly that this distributed hash table mechanism basically builds on a lot of 24-hour running servers, and there's nothing you can really do with Nutella with lots of computers who are running 10 hours a day at private places with 10 kilobyte per second bandwidth?
For some applications, you can do that. For example, if you are really worried about deep, deep censorship resistance against very persistent and powerful adversaries, then a more ad hoc mechanism may be ideal. But the price that you pay for that, for something that's very distributed and very ad hoc, is very high latency. It might take you a week to fetch an article that you want. Now, you might be prepared to do that if you were a lawyer in 50 years' time wanting to get a hold of a copy of the Fishman Affidavit. But from the point of view of a consumer service, it's not really going to work very well. So yeah, it can work in the right circumstances.
Thinking about the other examples you gave, like libraries, archives, other stuff, I was thinking about the possibility to search it. Do you think your system is easily searchable?
Well, I suppose the CS101 answer to that is that if you can store a big file, you can store a big inverted file, and there's your Google. You know, as an old Glimpse user, that's my instant reaction. So perhaps there's an opportunity for someone to build search facilities into a next generation Usenet. Perhaps, on the other hand, you just rely on Google or whoever to do that for you. I don't know. Well, if we're out of questions, I suppose it's time to go for a beer. It's certainly my throat saying it's that way. Thanks.